Now, this is not autobiographical. Because it says that I was insulted. It said, like, the essence of evil, Rabbi Ari Kahn. I thought that the implication over there was... then again, a couple of weeks ago, it had the Messiah, Rabbi Ari Kahn. I like that one much more. So don't worry. I don't let it go to my head either way. I think they had me talking about a heretic one. They also had the heretic Rabbi Ari Kahn. Anyway, we've played with this a little bit, this theme. When I want to talk about evil, what I really have in mind to do today is to talk about bad things which happen in the world. I plan on dealing with it primarily from a philosophical perspective. What I mean by that is the following. When we talk about bad things happening, there is two levels that one can, let's say, be bothered. For lack of a better term, I'll use that. Be bothered when bad things happen. Somebody could be bothered on an emotional level, and somebody could be bothered on an intellectual level. Correct? So the classic question, classic formulation, why do bad things happen to good people? Most people who I've spoken to are concerned with that issue. But now go back again. There's two ways to be concerned. One way would be that when a bad thing happens to somebody who's good, it bothers you emotionally. Like you're saying, wow, that's really such a shame. You know what I mean? And the second way to be bothered, the second way is that intellectually it doesn't seem to be right. Is the distinction clear or no? I'm not going to talk today about the emotional response. If a person responds emotionally that a bad thing happens to somebody good, that's very nice. What does it indicate? That they're warm and they're sensitive and they're caring and so on. But if somebody is bothered on an intellectual level, and as you say, this is more the philosophical issue, the philosophical topic. If somebody's bothered intellectually that something bad happens to somebody good, what is their premise? What are they assuming? Now you guys can help me out. What are they assuming?
That there's reward and punishment in this world.
Before that even. Before that, they're assuming that bad things shouldn't happen to good people. Right? Again, I want to go step by step so that nobody gets confused. If somebody is bothered that something bad happens to somebody good, their presumption is that nothing bad should happen to somebody's good. Very simple question on that. Why not? Why shouldn't something happen to something good? So then they have to say it's because they believe in a sense of justice. Okay, you with me still? If you believe in a sense of justice, it means that you believe there must be a judge. And if there must be a judge, it means that you believe there must be a God. Now, it could be, what I just now worked through, the individual who's trying to work this out, when they started their problem, they didn't necessarily believe in God. In fact, it's very easy to find people who say, why do bad things happen to good people? They're so bothered by this, I just don't believe in God. Great, so what do you believe? Then why are you bothered by the question? You hear what I'm saying? Which means, when it comes down to it, there's only two possibilities. Either things are random, or there is a God. There's no third possibility. If things are random, then you have no question why do bad things happen to good people. Bad things happen, that's all. Nothing to talk about. But if you're bothered by the question, again, intellectually, you're bothered, that why do bad things happen to good people, that question is a loaded question. When you formulate the question, why do bad things happen to good people, aside from the fact that it means that you think that you can judge who is good and who is bad and what's a bad thing and what's a good thing, all that aside, those are details. But it means that your sense of justice in the world would indicate that something bad should not happen to somebody good. Well, excuse me, why not? Can anybody tell me logically why, God forbid, cancer should strike a bad person and not a good person? The cells within their body seems to identify that this individual's behavior is below standard and that person's behavior is above standard. What kind of an absurdity is that? Does everybody understand what I'm asking? The only way that it's possible for a person to be bothered by bad things that happen to good people is if that person is assuming the existence of a God. An atheist cannot be bothered by this question. Emotionally, yes. An atheist can say it is very sad when bad things happen to good people. There's bad things that happen to good people. These people need comfort. They need to be spoken to. But I cannot imagine a bunch of atheists getting up by a convention and discussing this, the problem of theodicy. That's what they speak about in philosophy. The problem of theodicy, the problem of why bad things happen to good people. It's an absurdity. An atheist, if he's a real atheist, not every atheist is a real atheist, or not everybody who calls himself an atheist is a real atheist. An atheist says the world is random. If the world is random, then why be bothered when a bad thing happens to a good person? Bad things happen. That's it. There's no question. So let me conclude this prologue by saying the following. If somebody is convinced that they are intellectually bothered by this question of why do bad things happen to good people, it means that they believe in God, whether they like it or not. Doesn't mean they're happy with God. Doesn't mean they like God. I mean, people can be struggling with God and be very upset with God. That I can understand, but don't deny it. Because if you were denying God, that should cause a complete feeling of calmness, of resolution. There's no longer a question. Everything's random. But the people that get all worked up about it, that means they really do believe in God. Everybody appreciate what I'm saying? When I say about somebody being upset with God, there was a story that Elie Wiesel writes that who knows if this really happened, but he tells a tale that in one of the camps during the Holocaust, a bunch of Jews decided to get together and to put God on trial for the Holocaust. Right? Put God on trial. Find out if God was guilty. At the end of the deliberations, God was found guilty for the Holocaust. So now, here you go. God was put on trial. God was found guilty. And all these Jews are sitting around. God was just found guilty. So one looks at the other and says, what do we do now? So one says, well, it's getting a little dark outside. It's time to daven mincha. No. So why are you laughing? Does that sound funny? No, what they're saying is, okay, if God is guilty, God's responsible. Okay, so now what else am I going to do? Come to terms with it. It means I believe that God exists. I'm upset with God. God did it. Okay, now what? Let me go on. I can be upset with God, but realize that God exists. Because the only way not to realize that God exists is not to be bothered by the question at all. Is what you're saying? Yeah. Bad things happen. That's it. See, the problem is that sometimes people tend to let their questions become their answers. Holocaust is a very difficult thing to deal with. They said, why did the Holocaust happen? It's such a heavy thing that they end up coming to the conclusion. They say, you know what? Because of the Holocaust, I just can't believe in God. Can't believe in it. I'm so bothered by the Holocaust, I can't believe in God. So many good people, so many bad things happening, I can't believe in God. By the way, I'd argue the other way around. If there was ever an indication of a superhuman occurrence, it would be the Holocaust. Think about it. In terms of world politics, the fact that the Jews were isolated from all the nations of the world, so much destruction happening in such a short amount of time, it's hard to give credit to something else. Other than to say that this is an extraordinary experience. You know what? Let me spend a little bit more time with the Holocaust. Generally, when I give this class, I end up wanting to spend so much time with the issue itself of why bad things happen that I end up never getting to the Holocaust. I understand that this week you already had a class early about why bad things happen to good people. Were any of you there? Yeah? Somebody? I'm suffering. So let me focus today specifically on the Holocaust. And at least try to get to, you know, it fits with the title. If anything is the essence of evil, perhaps that was. Let me give one response. I say this is a response. This also needs a prologue. Man cannot understand God. This is not my opinion. Judaism says that. Lo machshavosai machshavoseichem. God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts. So before go any further, the presumption that I can understand and analyze or psychoanalyze the motivation for God to do things, it's an absurdity. I can't do it. What I can try to do is understand my interaction with God. That I can do. See, the Talmud on the one hand can tell us, I can't understand God. On the other hand, the Talmud can say, if the slightest thing happens to you, you have to say, where was God? Talmud says, if you put your hand in your pocket and look for 3 coins and pull out 2 coins, the Talmud says, you should say, why is my life so difficult? Why do I have to go through all the pain and suffering having to pull out another coin? says, why did God let this happen to me? It's interesting. Which means that when something bad happens to me, I have to say, what happened? Where was God? Do I say, what was God thinking? I don't know. What's going on with my relationship with God? In very simple terms, and this is general, before we get to the Holocaust, this is general. In very simple terms, God gives pain to the world. Whether the pain that God gives us will be meaningful pain or meaningless pain is up to us. If I choose to ignore my pain, then I have created meaningless pain in the world. If I choose to look and to try to analyze and to understand my pain, then I would have created meaningful pain in the world. And the difference between meaningful pain and meaningless pain could be all the difference between a theological crisis versus a theological or a religious growth. Let me give you an example. Anybody know what Lamaze is? Technique for birth. It's a technique for managing pain. Okay. When a woman gives birth, will she feel pain? Mm-hmm. Yes. If you teach her how to breathe, will she feel pain? Mm-hmm. Yes. But what's the worst part of pain? The worst part of pain is fear. Is that when the fear takes over, then the pain seems worse and worse, and it grows on itself to the point that you're overwhelmed. What Lamaze does is it helps teach you how to deal with the pain, to understand the pain, to feel the pain. You know one of the things they teach you in Lamaze is? Teach you focus on the baby that's coming out. Focus on the life which is coming into the world. Focus on something good. Right? Don't think about the pain. Breathe. Think about the baby. Think about the baby. I've done this if you haven't noticed. Around four times. Anyway, I'm very good at this. But what Lamaze tries to do is not to tell you the pain isn't there, but if a woman is going through the most excruciating labor pains, but is thinking about the baby, the life which is coming into the world, that pain takes upon meaning. When the pain takes upon meaning, you could have women who will tell you afterwards, it was the most painful thing in my life and the most exhilarating thing in my life. How can they tell you both? Because it was. I once had a terrible thought. What would happen if a woman heard, was told by the doctor, the baby was already, God forbid, dead? Do you think she'd be able to do Lamaze? To focus on the good? It's very difficult. So what I'm just saying is psychologically, without even getting on a religious level, psychologically, when a person finds meaning for their pain, things don't seem to hurt as much anymore. When a person doesn't find any meaning for their pain, then realize that you've created meaningless pain, and it hurts much more. Think about abuse. Abuse is one of these things where a vicious cycle is often created. You have people, they tell you, psychologists will tell you that many people who were abused as children will become abusers as adults. Right? Here's a person who had something traumatic take place to them, and they use their pain as a motivation to hurt somebody else. Why? Because of the pain they went through. That's terrible. Now, what are the other alternatives? So one alternative can be, well, simply ignore it, make it go away. Maimonides tells us that's terrible also. Because you know what you've done if you just ignore it and make it go away? You've created meaningless pain in your life. God gives us pain for a reason. Somebody else can take the pain of abuse and try to say, you know what, I know what it's like to be embarrassed, I know what it likes to feel pain, I know what it's like to be a lonely, scared person. Maybe there's another lonely, scared person that can use my help and my understanding. I had a conversation with a man 2 weeks ago, very successful, wealthy individual. Actually, famous individual as well, who told me about how the story about how his father had died. His father died at work. His father died of a heart attack when he was 6 years old. And he proceeded to tell me this whole terrible tale of how the police coming to his house. And as a little kid, you know, you see the police car coming to your house. You never see a police car in, you know, your own neighborhood coming right up to your house. And he lives in an apartment building, and all the kids were there. And they all followed the policeman, officers, up the stairs, and the guy stopped right in front of his apartment and opened the door and went right into his apartment. And then he heard his mother scream. And he couldn't believe it, and then he walks inside the apartment and he hears that his father had died. And he tells me all sorts of things that happened to the family afterwards, and he told me that till this very day, every single time he sees a police car, his heart stops. Just the fear, the association. And I asked him after he told me the whole thing. He and his brother We'll stop a second. He and his brother swore to themselves a year later. So they had to go on welfare. And a year later, they swore to themselves. His brother was 10, he was 6. They swore to themselves that they would never be poor and they'd always take care of one another. And they both became extremely successful people. And as he was telling me this, the truth is that he really broke down. He was crying. And I asked him, I said, have you ever reached out to a young kid who lost his father and told him, don't give up and don't be afraid and you can make yourself successful and there are other people who have done it? And he looked at me like, as if, you know, like this is like a stroke of God speaking to him or something. And he said, no, it never occurred to me. Meaning he was so focused on his own pain and his own existence and he wanted to pull himself up, it never even occurred to him to reach out to somebody else. And to me it seemed like such a strange thing that this pain has been in him for so many years that 50 years later, the man was literally in tears and he fell apart even trying to tell the story over, and there was just so much emotion. I said to him, you have so much emotion about this, why don't you give it over to somebody else and help pick them up? Don't you think that that would make it hurt less? Not take away the pain. Don't you think you can turn it into something positive? Make some little kid feel that he can also make it? I wish I could tell you what happened at the end. I don't know. He went back to New York. Anyway, let's get back to the Holocaust now. The Holocaust is an amount of pain which is inconceivable. I cannot, and therefore I will not, try to explain why it happened. But I do want to say a couple of things. First, there are those who will claim there's a whole theology has developed. People who say they cannot believe in God because of the Holocaust. What does this mean? Like this, these people who want to say that one cannot believe in a God after Auschwitz. Why? How could God allow something so terrible to happen? Now, I'm going to answer something which is completely theological. I don't know how much it's going to help you on a practical level, but I'll tell you the truth. This is my existence. I'm just opening up for you how I feel about it and I think about it. The Bible tells us at the end of Deuteronomy that there is going to come a time when man has become alienated from God, and the result of man's alienation is that God will hide himself from man. Which means that a time when man feels God hiding himself is a prophecy and is written in the Bible. Now, the problem for many people is that God is hiding himself. The fact that God is hiding himself is predicted in the Bible. Now, you could, of course, say that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and therefore, or you could say it's a very convenient excuse. Write the book and say that if ever you feel I'm not there, it's because I'm really are there, you just don't see me. And that's convenient. That's not the whole argument. The whole argument is the antithesis. There are surely times in history that we don't feel God. But what about the times in history when we do feel God? What about if the events of 1939 to 1945 disturb us? And they surely should. What about the events of 1947 to 1948? Obviously, I'm talking about the establishment of the state. Most people in this room are too young to even appreciate what I'm talking about. If one would study the world in terms of geopolitical or sociopolitical analysis, the establishment of the state is downright miraculous. If you go back and study which countries voted for the establishment of the state in the United Nations, it's unbelievable. If you look at the military situation, which the emerging state had to deal with, it's unbelievable. And if that's not enough, that's just the entree. It's the prelude. What about the events of 1967? If I would have made up the events of 1967, you'd all tell me that it was a fantasy. If I were to tell you I read it in a book, you would tell me, oh, it must have been a biblical story. Never really happened that way. A little blown out of proportion. Is everybody here willing to admit that? If I were to write down the events of the Six-Day War and say that in 6 days, the Israelites defeated all of the armies of the surrounding countries, they destroyed the air force of the Egyptian army within the first hour of the war. They destroyed the Jordanian army within the second hour of the war. And if I would tell you this story, you would say, wonderful story. Well, I just don't believe a word of it. Or maybe there really was a war and you're just blowing it out of proportion. My friends, this is fact. I've been told that there's a computer in the United States, I think it's in the Pentagon, where it does war games. and it's able to reenact every single battle which has ever taken place, which they, except for one battle, of course, or one war, the Six-Day War, they can't explain it. There's no logical way to explain what happened. And they finally came to the conclusion that there must be something about the Israeli army that they were not programming. And you know what it was? You know what the conclusion was? Well, I know what it is, but you know what they concluded what it was? The motivation of the Israeli soldiers. They were very motivated, and therefore they obliterated their enemies within 6 days. If you go for that, then fine. I have a simpler explanation. You know, sometimes a simple explanation is the correct explanation. By the way, that's a rule of logic. The simple explanation is always the correct one. Here, the simple explanation is that there's God, and that's all. But if the Six-Day War is not enough, and I really think it should be, you can look at the event. You can talk about the 73 War. You want to think of the 73 War? What about 1991? Remember anybody here remember the Gulf War? You guys saw it on television? Okay. Some of us were here during the war. Anybody was here during the war? You guys remember what happened? They told us before the war that every time a Scud fell during the Iran-Iraq War, right? Iraq was throwing Scuds at Iran. During the Iran-Iraq War, 7 people were killed on the average every time a Scud fell. 39 Scuds fell in Israel. How many? Anybody here know math? What should be 39 times 7? Whatever. A lot. Again?
276.
So none of you know math, okay.
No. 273.
So 273 people should have, again, I'm not in charge of more than that? 18 per Scud. And I understood it was 7, but if it's 18, then all the better. But I understood it's 7.
It's still a little bit misleading, because some of the missiles fell in,
Right. So on the average, when they fell during the Iran-Iraq War, 7 people killed on average. That's what averages do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's what they called averages.
Right.
Okay. But still, 39 Scuds fall, 1 person is killed. I remember when the war began, and my wife is very romantic, and she told me that... You know, I was in reserve duty in the Israeli army, and she told me that if the army ever came looking for me, she would hide me. She'd hide me in the closet, under the bed, whatever. So in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, phone call from the army, she answers the phone, and it's the army. She goes, hey, it's for you, it's the army. And that's it. They dragged me away in the middle of the night. But she's very romantic, so it's okay. I've learned to forgive her. I spent the rest of the war down south in a secret installation. I spent it down south. It was actually the best vacation I had in years, because the whole war was taking place up north, and in the center of the country. And there they go, and they send me down to Beersheba. Where nothing's going on over there, and they stationed a whole bunch of us, hundreds of us. They stationed in the hospital down in Soroka Hospital in Beersheba, because they were afraid that they would try to bomb in Dimona our so-called nuclear, which of course we don't have. Nuclear sites. So therefore, they put us all down south, and they, you know, trained us and all. And I'll just tell you right now, it was a great vacation. In the hospital, they had a base medrash. So I learned every morning. I said shir. There were lots of religious people. It was great. I said shir every day. And then in the afternoon, those poor soldiers who are soldiers. So they gave us, across the street was Ben Gurion University, which was, of course, empty because they shut down all the universities. So they gave us the key to their gym. So we played basketball every afternoon. It was like being in camp again. It was great. Morning, learning in the morning, playing ball in the afternoon. It was great. But every now and then, the guy was such a pain. Like, why 3 o'clock in the morning did the guy have to, like send these things, and the sirens would go off at 3 o'clock in the morning? And the amazing thing that would happen is that every single person there, and anybody who's in Israel at the time knows this, every single person there would pray. Hundreds of people would be sent down to Kazan. I was a big public place. Hundreds of people were sent down. And we had to get ready, because who knows that we may have to act. So all get ready there. So all the religious soldiers would be saying Tehillim. Right? They would open up the Tehillim Psalms, and they'd be saying Tehillim. The semi-religious soldiers would be saying something like they knew, right? Some prayer they remember. Asher Yatzar, I don't know. They were saying something. The secular soldiers were the most fascinating, because they would come over to the religious soldiers and they would like give us their address, you know, Jabotinsky Street, Ramat Gan, you know, don't forget my family, you know, get it. And they were like giving, they were writing it every time, they were writing it down, giving us their address and saying, don't forget to say something for my family. It was an amazing thing to me. You know, they say no atheists in a foxhole. There was no atheists over there. Everybody was praying. Again, you don't like what I'm saying? Fine. My experience Hundreds of people are praying. When hundreds of people pray, God answers. 39 studs full. None of them hit up population areas. Or, let's say it a little differently, most of them did hit population areas. In fact, city streets were destroyed. Buildings came down. But just nobody died. Oh. So it's actually quite bizarre. One person died. And they say he died of a heart attack. And by the way, you know the rumors about this, right? Nobody ever heard this? I don't know if this is true or not true, so what I don't know to be true, I'll just say it. Totally irresponsible of me, but I'll say it. That they claim the person who did die 2 months before the war began, there was like this major thing from secular people in Israel. They don't like the law. You know, in Israel, you're not allowed to grow pork. You know this? If anybody wants to open up a pork farm, you can't do it here. So you know the way that some of the kibbutzim beat the law? You're not allowed to grow pork in Israel. So you know what they do? They build boards, platforms, and they grow the pork on the platform. So it's not on Israel. It's on the platform. You like this? And the police don't arrest them. I'm serious. They really do this. Anyway, this guy who was killed, they claim, was marching through the streets of Ramat Gan holding a pig, protesting this antiquated law. Why can't, in a modern state, people grow pork? And that was the one guy that was killed. He was leading the fight, the crusade, against the prohibition of growing pigs in Israel. So again, I don't know if this is true or not true. This is what they said immediately afterwards, and like the rumors began to fly that this man was... Yeah, you know the guy?
No, I was going to say, if one person died, there was a lot of people that died from heart attacks, like a dozen or so. But from the actual blast. So.
Yeah.
And I never heard a missile blast in my backyard, but that could be pretty scary.
Okay. Yeah. Check up the facts on this. Anyway, it's very simple. Miracles took place. But now you hear what I'm saying? If I have difficulty and I say, I don't believe in God because the bad things happen, then how do I explain the good things that happen? So it goes the other way around. I'm a believer. Everybody knows that. I have a bias. I believe in God. I'm sorry, but I'm not going to apologize for it. Okay? That's the way that I am. So when something bad happens, I say, okay, God is hiding himself. When something good happens, I say God is revealing himself. So if anybody is going to say, look at the Holocaust, I can't believe in God because of Auschwitz, my response is going to be, but what about the other things that happened? And simply trying to explain away the establishment of the state based upon collective guilt of the European community or so on and so forth just doesn't seem to do it for me. It doesn't. And if that makes you happy, it doesn't explain the Six-Day War. And it doesn't explain the Scuds. And there are countless more things. So what I'm saying is that yes, bad things happen and good things happen. Those are two sides of a coin. I don't reject God when I see the bad. And I try to appreciate God when I see the good. Now, that is, personally, I told you, it's my response. That's the way that I feel. There's some people, though, who like to point fingers for the Holocaust. Say that the Holocaust is because of, and they like to point fingers at various segments of the Jewish community. For example, it's very easy to say, that the Holocaust happened because of the assimilation rate in pre-war Germany. Okay? Now, everybody understands the problem with that statement. One problem is that most of the people killed were not the Germans. Most of the people killed were the ultra-Orthodox in Hungary and in Poland. Yeah. So it's a little difficult to say to blame the assimilationists in Germany. But I want to take this a little bit further. If indeed the problem was the assimilation in Germany, whose fault is that? Is that the fault of the people who assimilated? Or is that the fault of the religious community that created an atmosphere that people wanted to assimilate? You understand my question? Like, why would a Jew growing up in a religious home at the turn of the century think that the outside world is more attractive? Now, I understand the outside world can be quite alluring. Western civilization will claim all the most wonderful things. Many people would want to do it, but it just must mean is that there's something fundamental to that. But I'll be honest, I don't think that you can look at something which is so profound and so deep and simply point a finger and say, oh, that's his fault, or that's their fault. I mean, it's clear that the Holocaust is something which befell the entire community, when something happens to entire Jewish world, one-third of our people are butchered, I think it's a little convenient, perhaps, to say, it's because they assimilated. But sometimes, as I said, people are concerned about the second part of the problem, that it was the religious who was specifically killed. So let me continue what I just now said about, you know, who's to blame. I read a passage in the Talmud. Give me the name of Shabbos there, please. Yellow. I don't know why Shabbos is yellow.
What's ever going to happen? These people are going to realize Medrash. You know, have to look.
Anyway. First time I saw this passage, what came to my mind immediately was the Holocaust. It says in it that God never changed his mind from something bad to something good. Excuse me. From something good to something bad. With the following exception. It's a prophecy which is talking about the destruction of the first temple, destruction of Jerusalem. It says that God has a discussion and God decides that when the destruction takes place, God tells... If anybody's keeping notes, it's stuff, nun hey. It says that God says to Gabriel, the angel, go down to the city and put marks of ink on all the foreheads of the righteous people, and they'll be saved when destruction will come, descend upon the city. And put marks of blood on all of the wicked people, for they'll be wiped out when the destruction comes to the city. That's the way the passage of Talmud begins, and it's based upon a verse in Ezekiel, Yechezkel, 9th chapter. So it says that God's aspect of judgment, Midas Hadin, says to God, hold it a second, not so quick. What's the difference between these people and these people? So God says, what are you talking about? These people are completely righteous, and these people are completely wicked. So God's aspect of justice says back to God, interesting dialogue, says back, yeah. But what did these righteous people do to try to convince the wicked people? So God says, I hereby swear in front of you, I attest, I swear in front of you, that even had they tried, they would not have been successful. To which the Midas Adin, justice, says back to God, yeah, you know that and I know that, but they didn't know that. They should have at least tried. So God then says to the angel, go down and put blood on the foreheads of all the righteous people, for they'll be the first ones killed when the plague comes. Do you understand the implication of this passage? And by the way, anybody here who studied a bit of Talmud, you always got to be careful with the yeshiva guys. Anybody ever studied Talmud? Say, yeah, it's just a story, just an agadata. There are at least two Rishonim who quote this as halacha. They say for Yerayim and the Smag. Both say, this is halacha. This isn't the story, it's halacha. It's Jewish law. That they conclude this is Jewish law. That righteous people bear responsibility for the not righteous people. If an atmosphere is created that people move away from God, it's no such thing as the assimilationists. We are one Jewish people. Don't tell me there are the Reformed Jews or the traditional Jews, the conservative Jews, the ecumenical Jews, or whatever sort of Jews you want. There are Jews, period. One people. And when we forget this, or when the righteous all say that we're okay and they're all wicked, at first glance, God says, yeah, you're right, you're all righteous. And at second glance, God says, yeah, but what about your responsibility for the rest? If anybody, after reading this passage, again, I'm not a prophet and I don't know what's in God's mind, but after reading this, suddenly that question of why so many righteous people died during the Holocaust became... I looked at it completely differently. It surely could be, there were two different communities. There were people who assimilated and people remained religious. Whose responsibility? Everybody's. There was not a perfect Jewish world. Which means, and remember I told you that God gives us pain? And what we have to do is find meaning for the pain? Is that only true on individual, sometimes half-meaningless things? I mean, think about the case of the Talmud. Put your hand in your pocket, look for three coins, and pull out two. The Talmud says, even by such mundane things, God is involved. But my friends, if God is involved by such mundane things, isn't God certainly involved in much bigger things? If a calamity can befall our people, and our response can be, well, you know, there's different sorts of communities, and maybe we haven't learned anything. Maybe it took a Hitler to teach us that this distinction between religious Jew and non-religious Jew, Hasidic Jew and non-Hasidic Jew, Litvak, Misnaget, whatever else you want, is not a true distinction. If we all died in the same camps, so maybe to divide ourselves into different communities was really the mistake. Again, I'm not telling you why it happened. What I'm asking is a different question. What I'm posing is, what are we going to learn out of it? What are we going to conclude from it? I'm not going to contradict myself. I told you before, I cannot penetrate God's mind. I cannot tell you why God did this. But what I could say is that God gave us pain. God gave us an incredible amount of pain. God gave us so much pain, it's difficult to fathom what type of lesson, moral or other, we can possibly have to learn out of it. But the alternative not to learn anything is abhorrent. If anything, what we have to do is walk out of this situation and say, what can I learn from the Holocaust? If not, then there's a lot of meaningless pain in the world. So much so for practical here and now suggestions. I want to get into the mystical side of things if I can with the remaining time. I want to start with the Ramban. This Ramban is essential in many aspects of Judaism. It has to do with what real liberation is about. I'll say this, you guys can use this for Pesach. If you remember this, till Pesach, you'll be okay. Okay. Why do we eat matzah on Pesach? Exactly. The Torah says, because the Jews had to leave so quickly, they didn't have time for the bread to rise. Right? When did the Jews leave Egypt? In the morning. It says at midnight, all the firstborn of the Egyptians died. In the morning, they left. So in the morning, they had to leave so quickly, the Egyptians chased them out. They didn't have time for the bread to rise. And everything's very simple. Except for one thing. What did the Jews do the evening before? They had the first Passover Seder. And what did they do at that first Passover Seder? They ate matzah. Why did they eat matzah? Oh, that's a simple reason. Because God told them to. It says, God said to Moses, speak to the children of Israel and tell them to prepare the Passover lambs for the sacrifice and to prepare matzah and mar. You know what mar is? Bitter herbs. When did they eat the bitter herbs? When they were still slaves in Egypt. They're still slaves. Why do they eat it? Matter of fact, why are they eating matzah? They eat matzah because they're going to leave so quickly the next day. They're going to leave so quickly, they don't have time. Which means they spent a couple of weeks baking the matzahs, getting ready to eat the matzahs, which is going to be a symbol of the bread they're going to bake and leave so quickly, not going to have time to leave. Is that unbelievable? And that's what the Bible says. Obviously, there's something very deep going on over here. The Jews are being asked in Egypt to celebrate their liberation. They're being asked to celebrate their liberation before they're liberated. Consider. The worst thing about being a slave is not the physical slavery. The worst thing about being a slave is the psychological torment of being a slave. The psychological torment can live within you many years after you're freed. In Tisha B'Av, I spoke about this a little bit, and I gave an example of the blacks in the United States. 100 years. 100 years later, there's still a mentality, an approach of being freed slaves or of slavery. On the other hand, you think about the Jews. They marched out of Auschwitz in 1945 and they created the land in 1947, 1948. That's unbelievable. That is absolutely unbelievable. You know, if nothing else I said is an indication of God's involvement, that's it. That you can have such a quick... I mean, you talk about, you know, the mythical phoenix bird out of the ashes to rise, but you think about what the Jews did, it's absolutely unbelievable. And when you go back and you look at the prophecy of Ezekiel, that the dry bones will yet rise, you start thinking about this, the deeper level, the dry bones rising, the dry bones, the ashes of Auschwitz rising, and the Jews coming back out of Auschwitz, out of Buchenwald, out of Treblinka, and coming back and marching into Israel and establishing a state. Unbelievable. God evidently in Egypt was concerned about this problem, the psychology of being a slave. And therefore he told the Jews who will sit in Egypt, I want you to celebrate your freedom. When did they celebrate their freedom? Before they were free. That means that somehow the Jews gathered within them the moral fortitude to be able to celebrate leaving Egypt while they were still in Egypt. They leaned back and they ate the matzah, which they will one day eat the next day, because they're going to leave so quickly they won't have time for it to rise. They trusted in God so much that they're going to be free that they felt free. They felt so free that to eat the bitter herbs, a symbol of their slavery, but they were still slaves. They didn't feel it anymore. They felt so free that to remind themselves what it used to be like to be a slave. That's psychological freedom. The Ramban, Nachmanides, points out, let's say the Messiah comes tomorrow, and there's no more war, and there's no more bloodshed. The lamb will lie with the lion, but we're still tormented about the Holocaust. He says, that is not full liberation. Full liberation means to be liberated like we were from Egypt, physically liberated and psychologically liberated. The Ramban therefore says that when the Messiah comes, we will understand every single day and every single event in Jewish history, every single catastrophe and every single calamity. That is part of the Messianic coming. It's not merely that we'll be free, it's that we'll be psychologically free. So I'll say right now, if there's anybody who here feels that the Holocaust is still something which torments us, that's part of existing in a world which doesn't have a Messiah and doesn't have a Messianic age. But a Messianic age means that there's no more torment, no more doubt. Everything becomes clear. That's the first part of what I would label the more mystical approach. I'm running out of time, and I'm not going to have time to develop the second idea properly, so I'm going to say it quickly. There was a generation that lived many generations ago that saw many miracles. It saw leaving Egypt. It saw the splitting of the sea. And nonetheless, that generation rebelled against God. Our sages say there's no greater desecration of God's name than an entire generation that sees this wonder, sees these miracles, and rejects it, and rejects God. These people desecrated God's name. Whole generation who died in the desert. Various mystics have written, and this is over a large period of time, the sources in the Zohar, and the Arizal speaks about it, that therefore there was going to need a whole generation who was going to die out simply because they're Jews, and what's called Al-Kiddush Hashem, to elevate God's name. And once that generation dies out, the mystics claimed, that then the Jews can return to their land. And then that generation, the next generation, can see all sorts of miracles again. It's like this collective taintedness within the collective soul of the Jewish people has to be elevated, and then we can come back. That's what it says in the Zohar. When I saw that passage also, again, this is totally on a mystical level. When I saw that passage as well, it also gave me a different perspective on the Holocaust. As I stated from the beginning, the Holocaust is something which is at times seems so large and so big and so difficult to deal with. But I said that I think what we really have to try to contemplate, not necessarily why it happened or who's to blame. The more important question is, what can I gain from it as an individual? What conclusions can I learn from it? What can I implement it about the Holocaust on a societal level? I mean, simply saying to make sure that no nation will be persecuted again is the beginning part. To say that to make sure there won't be any genocide again is the beginning part. But it has to be much more than that. That as a people, we have to try to learn the lessons of the Holocaust. Without it, we are creating, and we're the generation afterwards, we would be creating an incredible amount of meaninglessness. And that's something which we have to avoid at all costs.